see you all and also to see the sun. As some of you know, the weather forecast was so bad that at the last minute I decided to throw all my stuff in the car and come down here on Thursday. And as a result, I had Friday to spend in my native city, Springfield, and to revisit a place that I often visited as a child with my parents, the Springfield Museum. And probably the last time I was there before yesterday was maybe 1960, something like that. And, you know, I couldn't help but think of all the changes that, you know, had taken place. I remember in 1960 very well because that was the year I was running around the elementary school going, Nixon, Nixon, you're my man for the garbage can. And of course the Republican kids would say, Kennedy, Kennedy, you're my man for the garbage can. So we had a very enlightened debate going at that time. And then, you know, it sort of amazes me that only 10 years later I was getting in the car and driving myself up to go to college. you know, to me 10 years, that seemed like a fairly long time, but not a tremendously long time. But when you're young, it's truly an eon. But the funny thing was, you know, when I was in second grade in 1960, I was me. And I was driving up to school in 1970, I was me. And here I am at the beginning of old age, if not well into it, and I'm me. So who is this me? Me. And yet, very few people would recognize the me I was in 1960 among those who know me today. So one thing my parents did very frequently was take me to the Seymour Planetarium at the Springfield Museum. And there was a guy who did the planetarium show there back in the 50s and, called Frank Korkus. And I met him a few times. He made it a point to, you know, say hi to the kids who came into the planetarium. And the planetarium show I saw yesterday was very much like the one Frank Korkus gave, including some of the slides back. So they haven't changed them. But one thing that had changed was there was a little historical piece at the beginning about who Frank Korkus was, and it turned out not only was he the man who gave the planetarium show, he was the man who built the planetarium, and he also ultimately became the head of the Springfield Museum, working himself up from a very low position, and I guess starting in 1930. He also is the man who did the sculpture of the Native Americans, if you've seen that exhibit there. So he was a very talented man. And this show, just as Frank Korkus's show, started out just the same way, which is, well, lights would come down slowly and the sky would come up, and he'd say, this is a very particular kind of sky. This is the sky as it appears at this time of year, the transition between winter and spring. And he'd say the sky appears differently at different times of year. Why is that, kids? Because the earth is going round and round the sun. And so because the position of the earth is different relative to these stars, it seems to us that the stars are actually going around us. So he said, everything is in motion, constant motion. The earth is in motion, the sky, you know, even though it doesn't feel like it, the stars are in motion. But there's this one star over here, and you have like a red pointer that pointed, and he said, this star is the only star that we can see that doesn't appear to move. It's Polaris. It's the North Star. And the reason it doesn't seem to move is because it's exactly, the axis of the Earth is exactly aligned with Polaris. So as the Earth moves, Polaris doesn't seem to move because they're completely in sync. Of course, everything is moving, but the appearance is that Polaris is always in the same place in the northern sky. And so I was thinking, that's kind of like this me that we're all familiar with, because the me is it's a concept, right? It's a thought in our head. But it's one that our axis is kind of aligned with. So even though this our life is nothing but constant change, moment after moment after moment, because our axis is aligned with this me, there seems to be a constant me that doesn't change. So everything's changing and is crazy and is whirling around, but these are all experiences that are happening to me. Just as the stars seem to whirl around an unmoving Earth. But we can see this is a bit of a delusion. You know, it's a construct. It's a very convenient one, but it's simply an expedient that we use to locate ourselves in our constantly changing lives. So even though it's very useful, it does, as most expedients do, as medications do, it causes some problems as well. Because once there's a me, there's an everything else, and an everyone else, and it's all out there. And so then we start feeling kind of lonely, for one thing. Oh, here's me here, you know, and we start grasping at the things that seem out there to make me feel better about me, among other things. And we can see this problem very clearly come up in our zazen, because I believe all of us come into Zen practice with a certain model. And that model is based on me. And just as me doesn't appear to change no matter how many changes go on around us, me is just observing them, we come into practice thinking, okay, well, the point of practice is to get to a place that doesn't move, a place that's still, that's were sort of calm and unperturbed and very, very still. And so that becomes, just as me becomes the reference point with which our axis is aligned, in our Zen practice, our axis becomes aligned with this similarly expedient concept of stillness. And so we do a Zazen, and we realize, because we have this reference point of stillness, that our Zazen is very, very bad. Very, very bad. Because the goal is stillness, quiet, peace. And here's this crazy mind going, wow, I got to practice for a really, 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 really long time before all that stops and I can get to this still point, this place of peace. And, you know, this sort of delusive thinking is just comes about because of our dualistic thinking minds. What we find as we practice over the years is absolutely we do get to a still place of peace, and there's a fairly formulaic way of doing that. You don't talk to anybody for a week, and you follow a schedule where you don't have to think about anything that you're doing. And the food is very simple, and you don't have to prepare it. And, you know, when you start out doing those sessions, you know, you're going, mm-hmm. But, you know, you do a bunch of them, they become kind of routine, and you find out that after a week of no input, or very little input, the mind quiets down, doesn't have much to play with, and you get through a session and there's not all this stuff blurring things up and the world looks clear and everything stands out uniquely and beautifully. You go, I finally gotten the point of this Zen business. And that lasts for a couple of days maybe, if you're lucky. And causes and conditions change again, right? And the world looks very different under the causes and conditions of walking through Times Square in New York City. And if you're sitting peacefully in the middle of 42nd Street, that's not such good practice, in my opinion. So we have this real attachment to having a reference point, whether it's me or it's the peace and quiet that me wants to have. And as soon as there's a reference point, there's deviation from the reference point. And of course, you know, for the kind of person who gets down on ourselves, you know, God, it's nothing but deviation. And for some reason, the teachings don't get through to us as often as we hear. There's no reference point. There's nothing to attain. There's no possibility of deviation because there's no point to deviate from. You know, it's like feeling like you're deviating from having a nose because you can't see your nose. So there's a koan about this kind of painful situation. And I'll read the introduction to the koan because I think it very well demonstrates this reflects this kind of painful situation of feeling that there's a place you really need to get to and you're just not good enough to get there. So the introduction goes like this. Playing with reflections, struggling for the form, you don't recognize that the form is the source of the reflection. So playing with all these supposedly interfering thoughts that come up in your head and letting them go, and letting them go, and there's just too many of them, I can't get it. These are the reflections. So struggling with these reflections and trying to get to the true place, you don't recognize that this true place is the source of the reflections. In fact, without the reflections, there is no true place. They don't arrive separately. They arrive in the same vehicle. It goes on similarly, raising your voice to stop an echo, you don't know that the voice is the root of the echo. Quiet down, mind, quiet down, come on, relax, relax. Never realizing that relax, relax is the very place that you're seeking. This very moment, this is it. If it's not riding an ox looking for an ox, then it's using a wedge to remove a wedge. So that's a very common phrase in the Zen literature, riding an ox, looking for an ox, looking for the place of peace and stability. That still point out there, never realizing that you are the still point. It's not out there. Then it asks, how can you avoid these extremes? Maybe this simple case will help. So the Venerable Yang Yang, as Zhao Zhou or Joshu, when not a single thing is brought, then what? Zhao Zhou said, put it down. Yang Yang said, if I don't bring a single thing, what should I put down? Zhao Zhou said, then carry it out. So it sounds to me like our friend Yang Yang, you know, been practicing a while, was maybe they were having a retreat where he had been getting very deeply into his practice, and under those causes and conditions, his mind had gotten very, very calm and still, like a pure lake with no ripples. So I'm sure he was quite excited about this. Comes into the teacher. When not a single thing is brought, then what? There's not a single thing happening in my mind. Then what? And Zhao Zhou says, put it down. Now actually, you know, it's kind of literally a put down, but also it's very compassionate. Because as soon as you attach to a mind where not a single thing is brought, you're immediately creating a troubled, anxious mind. Those two kinds of things have no meaning apart from each other. So as soon as you're attached to having a still mind, you've already created a mind that's chaotic. So Zhao Zhou says, put it down. Yang Yang, he's not going to let go of his wonderful stillness. But if I don't bring a single thing, what should I put down? And Zhaozhou said, then carry it out. So that's a great kind of question. How do you carry it out? What does carry it out mean? If there is no particular Dharma to be realized, there is no particular mental state, that is it. Then what? Any attachment that we have, whether it's an attachment to a concept of self or an attachment to a concept of no self, whether it's an attachment to stillness and peace or an attachment to saying, oh, I'm such a miserable student, I'll never find the place of stillness, of peace. Any of that stuff, any of that mental stuff is going to be dualistic because our thinking, that's what thinking is, it's dualistic thought. It works in terms of opposites. So if there were no other colors in the world, that would not be black. Women in the world, there would be no men. So, how do we get out of this straitjacket? How do we carry it out? Well, the answer is really simple. Our practice is not dualistic. Our practice, whether it's our formal Zen practice, our practice of taking care of houses, our homes, our families, our practice of preparing a meal. None of that is dualistic. There's nothing dualistic about cutting a carrot. It's just. But of course, as soon as we say, oh, there's nothing dualistic going on here, then we're in the straitjacket again. But the good news is that even the straitjacket is not separate from this magnificent Dharma. So I frequently get it, you know, in interview, people twisting themselves up in knots, trying not to say the wrong thing. It's not possible to say the right thing because words and speech are dualistic when we're discussing ideas. If we're just talking blah 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 blah, well, that's not dualistic, that's what's going on. But you can't really deviate from this point that is no point. You're constantly carrying it, as Joshu says, and you carry it through your devoted practice, moment by moment by moment. And it's not a matter of being in some special mind state. It's not a matter when I used to go to Zen Mountain Monastery and we were washing up dishes in the kitchen, there would be people who would be washing dishes like. And we'd have about, you know, 100 dishes to get through. But they were, it's not about being mindful in that way. That's not mindfulness. Mindfulness is being the full mind present at this moment. 100 dishes got to go. There's no dualism in that practice. So this is why in Soto Zen we have the, you know, the phrase practice and enlightenment are not two things. And then everyone says, well, then why do you need to practice if there's no reference point? And the answer is, well, you can't avoid practicing. You have to decide how you want to practice. You have to decide what causes and conditions you want to create in order, hopefully, to get certain results. So there's you could have a practice of eating an ice cream sundae with every meal, with tons of whipped cream, the old Louis Prima song, topped with a pizza just for fun. And you could have one of those with every meal and watch TV all day, and that would be a very disciplined practice, and it would have certain results. But you can't avoid practice. Or you can practice with the 16 precepts, honoring the three treasures, refraining from unwholesome conduct of various kind. That will also have certain results. So we can't help being Buddha. Being Buddha means being no self, no reference point, nothing apart from the causes and conditions of this very moment. We can't help being a Buddha, but how we manifest as Buddha, well, that's a whole different thing. You know, the ice cream sundae man, comatose, in front of his TV is, he's doing harm to himself and to others. It's hard to see a manifested Buddha there. In a setting like this, it's easy to see seven or eight Buddhas manifesting because we're practicing as Buddhas. We're practicing the Buddha way. Practice the Buddha ways to manifest as Buddha, not to get somewhere or to get anything. As Dogen Zenji says, the practice of 2 years manifests as the practice of 2 years, of 10 years as the practice of 10 years, 30 years the practice of 30 years. The manifestations will be different, but not a single one of those manifestations is apart from the way. So, as Master Mumon likes to say, does that mean that all things are one, all things are Buddha, or does it mean that all things are different? You know, everything is Buddha, but they all look different. And Master Mumon wrote a verse where he said, if you're enlightened, everything is one. If you're deluded, everything is different and separate. If you're deluded, everything is one. If you're enlightened, everything is different and separate. So, I invite all of us in this day of sitting together in this beautiful place to see if we can let go of our need for the goal line or the reference point and just appreciate